Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Back here to our more usual kind of way of doing things in the second hour of the show, as we welcome back to the program Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is a family practice physician. I see here on my schedule that you are now chair of the Carl Clinic Family Medicine Department. Is that correct?
No, I used to be, but I'm not anymore.
Oh, well, see, I don't know why we even put that on there. He is a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and every other month is here on the program, always on a Monday, to answer questions. And we thought, you know, throughout the year, we talk from time to time with physicians who specialize in different parts of the body. But we thought that it would be a good idea on a fairly regular basis to have someone who could answer a wide range of questions. And he sees people of all ages in his practice, grown-ups and children. So if you have a question if it's about yourself, it could be about somebody in your family, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. Now, whenever we have a doctor here on the program, always I caution people, you know, we can't diagnose over the phone, but it's a way of getting some basic information, asking some basic questions, and I know that the doctor will do his best to help you out, and then it may be that you really need to see someone who can see you, but this can be a place to start if you have questions about health. So with that, the number 333-9455, same number as always. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455, and you give us a call and talk with the doctor. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, David.
We have someone already ready to go, so we will not make them wait. We'll talk with them. Caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Talking about ringworm and how it's contagious it is in some children. One question is, what can be, are there over-the-counter medications to treat ringworm? And second, what are all the ways that ringworm can be communicated from one individual to another? And I'll hang up to listen to you on the air.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Very good. I'm going to talk about ringworm.
Happy to. Ringworm got its name because of its appearance, not because it involves any type of infestation with any kind of parasitic worm. It produces a circular lesion on the skin, and that's where the name came from. But it's actually just a very common fungal infection on the skin. The same thing that people refer to as athlete's foot or jock itch. Ringworm is simply another form of fungal infection on the skin. It tends to be communicated simply by direct contact. Sitting next to somebody isn't going to give it to you, but direct skin-to-skin contact with the inciting organism will indeed transmit it from one individual to another. But it's in and of itself not terribly contagious unless you come in direct contact. And it is commonly treated with over-the-counter antifungal medications. There's a wide variety of, again, medications sold for athlete's foot and such. And these are frequently used. If they're not successful, there are some stronger prescription medications that can be used. In rare instances, somebody might need an oral antifungal agent to help get rid of it. This is much more common if you get a fungal infection in the scalp, but generally on the skin, something topical will usually take care of it.
And the thing is, these patches can be itchy. Is it possible to spread the infection if you scratch it and you get some of whatever the agent is, and then you touch someplace else? You can move it around on your own body that way?
Yes, you can.
Okay. So
it's not terribly common, but it is possible.
All right. So and those things, those over-the-counter things that you would use for athlete's foot, you use that same stuff. And then if you are using that for a while and it doesn't seem to, how long would you suggest that someone try that before then calling your doctor and thinking about moving on to something a little bit stronger?
Generally speaking, if you have a presumptive diagnosis of a fungal skin rash and you're treating it with an appropriate over-the-counter antifungal agent, and inside 7 to 10 days you haven't seen significant improvement, then really the diagnosis is in question, and it's probably reasonable to look at it.
Okay.
It may not be gone, but it certainly ought to be a whole lot better. And generally speaking, if it's improving. You just keep treating it until it's all gone, and then go another day or two to make sure it's not going to come back. Fungal infections on the skin are notoriously recurrent.
Okay. Well, is there something that it could be that would be that maybe would look like ringworm, but it actually would be something else?
There are a whole host of dermatologic rashes, some of which are circular. There are also some medical illnesses that have skin manifestations. So at that point, if it, you know, if you've thought that that's what you're treating and it's not improving after 7 to 10 days, then I would go and get a second opinion.
Okay. And just into if you have, say you have a family, you have somebody that somehow turns up with this, is there anything in particular you want to do just to make sure that it doesn't go from, end up going from person to person? Does it have to be skin to skin contact?
Well, I wouldn't share a washcloth or a towel and let somebody's rubbed all over their skin and then, you know, have somebody else use it again. But nothing real dramatic that you have to be aware of.
Okay. Okay. I hope that answers the question. We have someone else here, someone in Vermilion County. It's line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk about possible, I realize you don't wouldn't diagnose, for them, but possibilities for explaining leg pain. At its best, it's only in the knee, but when it's been over 4 or 5 days, and I do have an appointment later in the week with the doctor, but I'd like to be able to research it a little. Pain all the way from the thigh down to the lower calf does not involve the foot or ankle. I can't identify whether it's muscular or deep in the bone. I get calcium and potassium, so I don't think it's like that. I don't have enough apple juice or orange juice. But it sort of helps to massage it, but it's not a muscle cramp.
And has it been associated with any change in your activities of late?
No, not like with snow shoveling, although I, you know, did shovel a week and a half ago, but I mm-hmm. didn't shovel in this big one. I thought about whether it could have to do with, you know, twisting on that knee, but no, I don't identify it with a change in activity, and I'm fairly active.
Okay. Generally speaking, you know, if you were concerned about a bone-related problem, it would be kind of unusual to have something from the thigh down to the calf, because you're now talking about the femur or your thigh bone and your tibia. So you'd have two different bones basically involved simultaneously, which would be kind of unusual. So in most likelihood, you're probably dealing with something muscular, though occasionally a knee joint related problem can radiate pain up or down, sometimes both. Any difficulty with moving the knee itself?
Yeah, it hurts to put weight on it, and like if I get up, you know, from sitting, it takes me several seconds to kind of get that leg sort of swinging. Once I get it mobile and take a step or two, then I can walk, although it's noticeably a limp, and I can tough it out. I mean, I've not taken any painkillers to mask mm-hmm. it, but it's definitely something some people would not be able to tolerate the pain of.
And is there any swelling in the knee joint
There's
itself?
No swelling anywhere, and no discoloration.
And does the knee lock, please?
No. No, once I get it bent, it hurts a little, but I can bend it and swing it. I can do, you know, the usual strengthening exercises.
Mm-hmm. And does it give way once you're walking on it?
It threatens to. It hasn't. But, you know, like if I were carrying a tray of, say, glassware down the stairs or something, I would lean on the wall because, I would be afraid it would drop.
You wouldn't quite trust it.
No.
Okay. That type of symptoms suggests more of a problem in the knee joint itself. There are a variety of internal derangements that can occur with the knee joint that, given the degree of discomfort that you're having, wouldn't necessarily be unusual or unlikely to have pain radiating up or down or farther in the leg. So you may want to go back and look at whether there was any particular injury or kind of activity where you may have put some more pressure on that knee. And alternatively, some knee problems are just a matter of cumulative wear and tear, and then they start to give people trouble. But in your particular case, You're going to obviously need a detailed examination of your knee to see if you can identify any possible derangement inside it. But your problem, as you describe it, doesn't really sound like it's a bone-related problem. And in the absence of any swelling or discoloration, probably not necessarily a muscular problem either. So given what you've described so far, I'm a little bit more suspicious that it's in your knee joint.
Okay. So would this be possibly something as simple as arthritis?
Quite possibly.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. We'll come back here to Urbana for the next caller here, line number one. Hello.
Hi. At least once in the past, you've had a caller who's been concerned about essentially racial profiling with regard to medical things. That's a broad way to describe it. That's just what comes to mind. I wanted to mention that there's a Consumer Reports on Health article in the March 2000 issue, 2-page, talking about ethnic heritage and how and if it affects health risks, including a table that shows, it's got 2, 4, 6, illnesses with, and it shows where ethnic groups tend to fall and what to do. And the point is that race can't be ignored, but it also can't be taken into account simplistically, and that there are 42 genetic variants that are linked to how people respond, for instance, just to drugs. And more than two-thirds of those have notable differences in frequency if you take broad populations of blacks and whites. And because many people have intermarried over the generations, obviously you can't just look at somebody on the outside and say, well, this is the group you fall into. But if that listener or other people wanted to see some more rational talk about this issue, I do suggest this article. Presumably a local library would have it. And I thought it was pretty well done. Thanks.
Okay. Well, I don't know. You want to comment on that at all?
Well, I think the caller brings up a good point, and I think people of particular ethnic or even geographic backgrounds should try and be aware of things that they may statistically be at a little higher risk for. The problem that we have with a number of medical studies is that a fair number of them are done on just sort of average white middle-aged American males. And the question then becomes, well, can you generalize those results, you know, to black females or, you know, Chinese adolescents or, you know, whatever other population that you're dealing with? And in many instances, the answer is we don't know because those other studies really haven't been done. So the information that we do have, in some respects, is limited, but it's all that we have. Now, I think going forward, a number of the medical and pharmaceutical companies are paying attention to that and trying to have a more broadly based population study that would be more representative of the country. But that's actually going to be more of a problem to then sort out, well, are there racial or ethnic differences then in terms of the response if you don't have enough people in there? So for African-American men, we tell them that, generally speaking, there's a higher risk for prostate cancer. They should be coming in a little sooner, and they should be a little bit more diligent about getting that checked. For some odd reason, they have a higher risk for glaucoma, and we try and remind them to go see the eye doctor. But almost every ethnic background has something that is a little bit more prevalent in their society than in somebody else's. For some reason, Japanese people tend to get more gastric cancers. That's relatively uncommon here. It's much more common there. Why? You know, I don't know. Yeah. And there are a variety of illnesses that seem to be more predominant either in certain ethnic groups or in certain geographic locations. And people should be simply aware of that. And, you know, hopefully their physician will take that into account when it comes to making a diagnosis and then ultimately prescribing as well. Yeah.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He is on this program every other month on a Monday for this kind of general conversation we just call Talk to the Family Doctor. So the idea is that if you have some range of general healthcare questions, you can call and talk with him a little bit, and maybe he can help you figure things out, what may be going on. And then, of course, you may well want to pursue that with your own physician or with someone who can see you. But this is a place you can start if you have some basic kind of questions. They're welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign and line 2. Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Uh-huh.
I have had a lot of problems in the last couple of years with my arms, falling asleep, and a severe pain in my thumb. And my family practice doctor suggested that it might be carpal tunnel. I've also developed a tremor in my right hand. And my brother told me that I should go. He's also a doctor. And he told me that I should have an EMG, electromyography. What is electromyography, and how does it work, and how could it help with this possible problem?
Good question. The EMG, or electromyography examination, also usually includes what's called a nerve conduction velocity study to make sort of a complicated physiological system simple. Your nerves are a little electrical circuit that then go down to the muscles and activate them, much like your electric line turns on your light bulbs at home. And the EMG and nerve conduction velocity are a way of testing to see if that little electrical circuit is still intact. And if there is a problem, much like an electrician going from one spot to the next to figure out where the break in the circuit is, they try to identify whether the problem's really in the muscle or in the nerve, and then what particular kind of problem is it. With the arms falling asleep and pain radiating into your hand and thumb in particular, those are fairly common symptoms seen with carpal tunnel syndrome, which is a problem where there's too much pressure on the nerve as it runs through the wrist. And yet the tremor that you just described is not a typical symptom seen with just carpal tunnel syndrome. So it raises a question as to whether there's either something else instead or in addition to going on. And as part of a detailed neurological evaluation, the EMG is commonly used to try and help sort that out.
Is it painful?
Well, yes, in the sense that they use a small electric needle to stimulate the nerve at certain points to see if that connection all the way down to the muscle is intact. And people do indeed complain about the test. You know, it's not horrible, but it is not painless.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. You're welcome. Thank you for the call. Our guest again, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. If you're interested in calling in here and have some kind of healthcare question, I know he'll do his best to help you out. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Well, we've been doing this for a while now, and in the fall, and the one of the things we talk a lot about is into the winter, colds and flu. We nag people about getting their flu shots. We talk about what you can do to try and avoid being sick. It just sort of strikes me that it seems, as far as flu is concerned, in true influenza, that it hasn't been a terribly severe flu season. Am I right?
I hope you're knocking on wood as you say that.
I think there are some here. I can find some.
But you are correct. In terms of actual influenza, it has been, at least in our area, relatively mild. Now, whether that's because people have indeed heeded the advice to go get their flu shots, or whether it's just one of those temporal and geographic variations over time, I don't know. But in fact, it really hasn't been too bad at all. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that might have something to do with the fact that until relatively recently, the winter was fairly mild. And I don't know if the outside temperature has anything to do with it, or the fact that maybe people can be outside a little bit more, and they're not spending as much time
indoors
with other sick people where right. there's the opportunity for things to get passed around.
I think that does have some bearing, but there are also just seasonal variations in the intensity of flu outbreaks, and we may simply be on the lucky end of the curve.
Yeah, okay. Well, again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that maybe we might talk a little bit about, some folks may have seen some of the stories that were in the news here fairly recently about the incidence of autism and about the fact that it seems that it is sort of, you know, the headline on the story is that autism may be more common than we had thought. And any time you have a story like that, I guess my first question is, well, okay, is it because we're looking for it more, we are more aware of it, or could, in fact, could there be some reason that there actually is more? Certainly people are more aware of it, and I would expect that probably that parents think about it more. I don't know if pediatricians and doctors who work with children are also thinking about it more.
Yes, very, very true. And there has been some controversy over autism over the years. Obviously, people would like to try and find either preventable or treatable cause and then, address the problem. But to date, there really hasn't been anything identified. But periodically, over time, various things have been identified as potentially either as causal or at least associated with outbreaks of autism. The most recent one was, was it mercury in the immunizations that kids were getting? And because that's such a common thing, and there is so much benefit from immunizing children, the medical societies basically went back and looked at that in a very, very detailed fashion and really couldn't find any definitive evidence to say that, immunizations were in any way related to autism. Now, you did bring up some good points, which is people are indeed more aware of it. And I think there is more of an effort to look for it, identify it, and that leads to then identifying more cases. And there were also folks years ago who got lumped into different categories. There was a category called minimally brain damaged. There were kids who were, quote, mildly retarded. Well, those classifications really aren't being used much anymore, and a whole bunch of folks who used to be called that are now called, one variation or form of autism or another. So you basically shifted a whole bunch of people into this new category. And prior to, I forget what the date was, but, prior to, 20 years ago, there weren't any real statistics kept on autism as a separate category. And now there is. And so you can say, well, before they kept statistics, now we have a 100% increase. Well, there weren't any last year, and there's one this year. So you can do all sorts of interesting things with numbers. But there was just recently published, and I'm blanking on where, an epidemiologist's sort of review of this whole topic. And he basically says that he doesn't think that there is a big increase in the actual number of cases that are in the population, but that better identification, more strict definitions of what constitute autism have allowed the numbers to look like they are steadily increasing. And it's a question of comparing sort of apples to oranges when you look at the old data versus the new data.
Okay. Well, we're at midpoint here already. We have several other callers, and we will take them here again in order and start with someone in Urbana on line one. Hello.
I just turned on the radio, and I hope nobody else asked this question today. What does it indicate, and should I do something about it when, after a nap or at the end of a nap, I feel both hands and both arms are sort of tingly-tingly as if they had fallen asleep? nothing to do with my feet or my legs to this point, and perhaps my age indicates something in that I'm over 77, just turned 78. So would tingling hands, or falling asleep arms and hands, indicate that I should see a doctor?
In and of itself, not necessarily. If that very quickly goes away once you awaken, get up, move around, you know, kind of shake your hands or your arms, it can simply be something as simple as the position in which you were sleeping, causing your hands and arms to feel like they're going to sleep. And in other instances, what you describe can be a symptom of mild carpal tunnel syndrome as well. But if there's no significant pain or weakness, no, it's not anything urgent. It simply depends on how much of a problem it is to you and what you're wanting to do about it.
Right. Now, I wasn't sleeping on top of my arms or hands. I had them exposed on top, and even on occasion while watching television and falling asleep for a few minutes and getting awake, they'd have fallen asleep. I call it falling asleep.
Mm-hmm.
But they started tingling, and that sort of got me awake,
right.
And I thought, oh, goodness, I have to move around a little bit.
Right. And the most common reason for that is the position with the elbows and wrists bent.
Uh-huh.
You don't necessarily have to be, you know, like laying on your arm,
right,
to make you go to sleep. But if the elbow and wrist are bent significantly, you can put enough pressure on the nerve to cause that sensation.
Right. That might be part of the problem. Good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Right, thanks for the call. Bye-bye. Let's go next to line number two. And this is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. Hi.
Could you say something about the condition referred to as benign non-essential tremor.
Benign non-essential tremor?
Yes.
I don't think that I'm necessarily familiar with that. There is a benign essential tremor.
Well, I think that's probably what I meant to say, yes.
Okay. This is a situation where basically somebody has a tremor, and after investigation, it is determined that it is not related to any other neurological disorder. This is sometimes a familial tendency, and there's thought to be some genetic potential for inheritance here. But basically, people have a shake or a tremor in some part of their body that does not necessarily indicate any other neurological disorder. But it's pretty much a diagnosis of exclusion. You basically go through the medical process of evaluating somebody for other medical illnesses, whether it's, you know, Parkinson's or multiple sclerosis or any other, you know, degenerative neurological disease. And once you've excluded those and you don't see any significant progression in any kind of neurological deficit, then you can basically reach a conclusion that says, yes, you have a tremor. It's just part of who you are, and it's not part of any other illness.
All right. Next, we will talk with someone in Villa Grove. This is line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a question. I've recently been diagnosed with a condition called lichen planus inside my mouth. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay. For my doctor and an oral surgeon recommended a cream, an ointment that actually doesn't do anything that I can see to help it at all. And my dentist sent me information on a website for a product called LP Tab, which I did order. Anyway, I'm not sure it's doing anything either. I had to order it from Pakistan, so.
Whoa.
I was leery about what it was, but the doctor and the dentist and the oral surgeon all said it was safe. But I'm not getting any results, and I went on my own research. I can't find anything either.
This was diagnosed when you had sort of a white patch in your mouth?
Yes.
Yeah. To the best of my knowledge, nobody really knows why people get it, it can occur on the skin as well and not just inside the mouth. So we actually see this on people's skin and other locations. It's usually, if treated at all, treated with some topical cortisone-type medication. That may be the ointment that you were originally given. But there really isn't any type of sort of magic here, take this, it goes away and never comes back kind of treatment that I'm aware of. And I'm afraid I don't know what LP tabs are.
Yes.
So I don't have really any comment on that. It is thought to be a chronic problem that is sort of controlled, but I'm not aware of anything that, you know, uniformly makes it go away.
Controlled just by the topical ointment?
Typically, yes.
And the ointment that I have says for external use only. So that was a flag for me to be putting it inside my cheek.
Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, unless it's a toxic substance, it's not going to be a problem. But most of the, you know, topical cortisone-based medications are intended for skin use.
Okay. Is there, I guess, it's coming to the point now where it's flaring up constantly and spreading as far as from one cheek inside to the other. Mm-hmm. I don't have any on the outside of my skin, but it's very uncomfortable. And would you have any idea of where I might go next?
Other than another opinion from an oral surgeon, I don't have any other specific recommendations.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for the call. Our guest here this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month on a Monday, he's here for this show. We just call it Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that if you have general health care questions, you can call us, and he will do his best to kind of help you out, help you think about what's going on and then what you might do. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. That's the local number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign County, line three. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to ask about chronic hives. Hives appear as sometimes circular, almost ringworm-type things,
mm-hmm.
sometimes over large areas. Sometimes they're quite small. They come and disappear on a daily basis, and sometimes go away for a day or two, or maybe a little bit more, and then come back despite the use of, first of all, a topical a cream type thing, and then other medication prescribed by a dermatologist.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any hope for permanent relief or disappearance of this, or is this simply something that you treat as they come back?
Well, sort of the bad news here is that probably greater than 50% of the folks who have chronic problems with hives, we can't find an underlying medical explanation for
it. The etiology is a mystery.
Right. And I'm going to assume that your dermatologist looked at a few other derm-related problems and that your regular physician had ordered some laboratory studies related to some other medical conditions that are sometimes associated with hives. But as I said, in the vast majority of cases, they all come back normal,
mm-hmm.
and we're simply left with somebody who periodically gets hives. And no, other than treating them when they come up, there really isn't a lot else to do. The majority of times, hives is an allergic reaction to something. And so in some instances, if we're still suspicious about that, we'll have you meet with one of the allergists to see if there's something that you could be tested for to see if that might be contributing to it. In some instances, certain medical conditions, thyroid disorders, autoimmune disorders, can be associated with recurrent hives. And there's some laboratory testing for those sorts of things. But the hives themselves are relatively common in people who have it chronically. The majority of them are actually pretty healthy and don't have an underlying illness, that, at least that we can identify.
Case, yeah. And so it's just put up.
As best as you can.
Okay. Thank
you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Back here to someone in Champaign. This would be line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I was recently at a baseball camp. I'm 40 years old, and I was, as the week went along, my knees became more and more sore, although there was never an incident I could point to and say, I hurt my knee. In the week since I've been back, the knees have still been very sore. It's difficult to walk. And I was wondering, you know, is it possible I did some actual damage, even though I can't say, here's where I hurt my knee?
If you can't recall a specific incident, no. In all likelihood, you were probably a lot more active at the camp than you normally are, and your knees are simply reminding you that you're not 18.
Right.
But I would anticipate that simply with time, maybe some anti-inflammatory type agent, if you'd want to take something like, you know, ibuprofen or naproxen, that should steadily settle down. If you have, you know, persistent discomfort, you know, several weeks from now that hasn't resolved, then it would be worthwhile checking. But given your history of the activity there, it's probably just a little more use than you're otherwise used to.
Right. So a couple weeks for it to clear up is not unusual.
No, not at all.
Okay. All right, that's my question.
All
thanks.
Right, very good. Well, thanks for the call. And again, I will say that our guest in Sparta Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month on a Monday, he's here for the show. We call it Talk to the Family Doctor. It's a general kind of wide open opportunity for people to ask health care questions. And I know he will do his best to help you out, even though he can't see you, and you may well have to pursue this with your own doctor. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455.
Those skin conditions are especially difficult to deal with over the radio.
There are several dermatologists among our friends here on Focus 580, and they're here on the program. Yes, we say the same thing. Can you hold that rash up to the phone so that we can see that? I'm curious, we were talking a little earlier about the issue about autism,
mm-hmm.
and particularly about you mentioned it as I think some people are concerned that, or some people have thought that maybe the fact that there was some mercury in the standard immunizations that we give to mm-hmm. children, that might, you know, might be what's going on. And it's my understanding that the reason the mercury is it's a preservative.
Correct.
And also that the vaccine manufacturers, because of the concern about, you know, mercury and its toxicity, mm-hmm. were looking for other things that would do that same function so
yes.
that there wouldn't be mercury
right.
in those immunizations.
And they are indeed gradually moving all of the immunizations to be mercury-free.
All right. So eventually
yes.
we'll get to that point where that's not going to be, at least from that point forward,
an
that
issue.
Shouldn't be an issue because it just won't be in there anymore.
Right.
But that's just at present, there still is?
I think in certain vaccines, there still are.
Okay. Well, let's go to somebody else here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My husband has a finger that hurts him, and we kind of think it's from holding a heavy book in the same position quite a while. I suggested that it was probably inflamed in a bit inside, and why doesn't he take ibuprofen? And he read the label, and he says, well, I take an aspirin every day, so I can't take this. What do you think?
It's still possible to use something like ibuprofen, even if you're taking that single aspirin a day for, you know, cardiovascular reasons. That in and of itself isn't a contraindication. There are some thoughts that perhaps your aspirin for what it's being asked to do might be a little less effective while you're taking some other anti-inflammatory agent, but there's really no contraindication to doing so.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank Bye-bye. You. Let's go then to another caller here. This is Champaign, line two. Hello.
Yes?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, hello. I have a question. I was recently in a car wreck. My car was hit. And I had x-rays afterwards, and nothing showed up as cracked or anything in the neck or the back. But I have been having, and I haven't been able to get in to see my GP. I've got another 2 weeks to wait. But I've been having tingling in my shoulder blades, and also I find that it's moving down toward the base of my spine and my hips. And especially when I wake up in the morning, I'm very, very stiff and have pain in the hip area. Any advice? Any ideas?
With the x-rays being negative, in all likelihood, you have some complaints that are typically related to the stretching of muscles along the spine. Unfortunately, during an accident, you generally get moved around a little bit, even if you don't go too far because of your seatbelt or airbag. The sudden movement in a different direction and sort of the recoil back can cause stretching of the muscles along the spine. The classic description of that is the person who has neck pain after this kind of accident, commonly referred to as whiplash. And it's simply that quick stretching and recoil of the muscles. Generally speaking, this is something that gets better over time, but we tell people that it will indeed be several weeks. Those muscles tend to stiffen up then when you're not active, which is why you're a little worse in the morning than you are over the course of the day when you've gotten up and kind of moved and stretched things out a little bit. But just some general stretching exercises, and again, if you're uncomfortable enough, the anti-inflammatory agents can sometimes provide a little relief. But unless you're developing other symptoms, specifically where you're having persistent numbness or tingling or weakness in an extremity, most of the time this muscle stretching gets better by itself.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. And let's see. I believe that we have another caller here in Champaign, also line one. Hello.
Hello. Is this me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay, I have two questions. One sort of general, but the other one is kind of specific. I have one of my feet, when I walk on it, it feels like I'm walking on marbles or something like that. They're right in the ball of the foot. And I don't know what causes that. Do you have any notion?
In some instances, what can occur in that particular location is a deviation of what's called the metatarsal, or the bone that goes down towards your toe.
Uh-huh.
And that can actually get sort of misaligned in the sense that it's lower than the other bone, so that when you step down, you feel it first and then the other ones. So it's going to feel like there's something down there. You basically need an x-ray to prove that. It oftentimes is treated with an orthotic to shift the pressure of the foot.
So I should probably visit a foot doctor.
A podiatrist would be a very reasonable person to check with.
Okay, my second question is just kind of a general information thing. How does Imodium work? I know what it does, but how does it actually accomplish that? And I'll hang up and listen to you on the air. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Most of the antidiarrheal medications work by inhibiting the normal process of peristalsis, which is the muscular contraction of the intestinal tract to move things forward. When that whole process gets going a little too fast, there isn't enough time for the moisture to be reabsorbed out of the stool, so we get what people refer to as diarrhea, a liquidy type stool. So basically what you're trying to do is slow down peristalsis so there's enough time to reabsorb the water back out of the stools so that you basically have a little bit more firmer consistency.
Mm. Well, obviously there are – the diarrhea can be a symptom of a lot of different things.
Sure can.
And it can be something that might just be kind of a nuisance, or it could be an indication of something much more serious.
Correct.
How do you know the difference? And if you're having this problem and maybe you have it for a day or two and you decide, okay, well, this is a nuisance, I can get something over the counter that can kind of help with mm-hmm. this. How do you tell the difference between something that's just a nuisance and something that is a sign of a more serious problem.
Okay. Well, you know, if you go to the church picnic and, you know, 12 of you all come down with diarrhea, you know, probably somebody brought bad mayonnaise in the potato salad or something. Mm. And that's going to literally run its course in a day or two, and things will settle down. Along the same lines, if there are reports of gastroenteritis in the community, lots of folks with, you know, vomiting and diarrhea, and you happen to have a coworker with that, and you come down with it, again, within a few days, things should settle down pretty much on their own. We become concerned when diarrhea is persistent, especially if you've done the right things. In most instances, your body's basically telling you, I'm having trouble digesting right now. And if you keep putting food in there, it's going to continue to have trouble digesting. So in many instances, we tell people don't aggravate the problem by forcing your intestinal tract to digest. Simply switch to clear liquids, water, flat ginger ale, 7-Up. We often use Gatorade as a nice replacement fluid, though I tell people don't drink the red stuff because then you're going to call me and tell me that you're bleeding. So pick a color that we know isn't going to be a problem. Yeah. But in most instances, if you let the intestinal tract rest, it'll pretty much heal its own if it's a minor irritation. Mm-hmm. People who have persistent diarrhea despite a clear liquid diet, that's something that we need to know about. Somebody who says, and I have blood in my stools, and I have a fever, and I'm losing significant amount of weight, those are red flags. Those are things that say, you know, this is not just the normal, typical, gee, I picked up a little bug and, you know, it'll go away in a couple of days.
Yeah.
So significant diarrhea that persists, associated with blood, fever, weight loss, those are not things that you people should ignore and just take over-the-counter medication for. If you have an intestinal infection, something that really needs to be treated, you have to think about the fact that when you use an antidiarrheal medication, all you're doing really is trapping it inside. That's not going to necessarily help you get better sooner. So there's always this trade-off between reducing the symptoms and actually treating the illness. And so in those serious instances, one, people generally find that the antidiarrheals don't help as much, and two, they can really be, in some instances, counterproductive.
Well, is it usually the case that what happens when you're having diarrhea is that what your body is saying is there's something in here that we need to get out,
mm-hmm.
and this is the most efficient way of essentially flushing your system out and saying, look, everything's got to go. Everything's
right.
Got to get out of here.
Right.
Just to because there's some bad stuff in, we've got to get rid of it.
Right. And then you need to give your body a period of time to rest. And that's why we're switching to clear liquids instead of still asking the body to digest, because during that process, it doesn't digest very well. And if you keep putting food in there, it's not going to be digested and it's going to keep running out the other end. But most of the diarrhea problems that we see are usually just temporary, short-lived forms of, most of them are viral infections, but there are bacterial infections, there are parasitic infections. You know, somebody says, well, I just came back from, you know, Mexico or South America or had something weird or odd to eat. Mm-hmm. We need to think about those things. And then people who don't necessarily have any type of infection can have other forms of intestinal illnesses. The person who says, gee, you know, could I have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease or, you know, could I have celiac sprue? These are all things that in the setting of persistent diarrhea would need to be thought of and investigated. One of the other things that we always have to think about with diarrhea is, you know, have you been on antibiotics recently? That's actually a fairly common cause of people with diarrhea. So if it's it seems relatively minor, goes away within a day or two, I wouldn't make a big deal out of it. But if it persists more than a couple of days despite a clear liquid diet and the use of an over-the-counter medication, then that's probably worth checking out.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that it's the kind of thing that maybe people are concerned about, as we now periodically hear with, I think, a little bit more regularity than we have concerns about food poisoning. Mm-hmm. And just recently in the news, we have a problem
with peanut butter.
Right. Which really, when I saw that story first, my question was, how does salmonella get into peanut butter?
Right.
It seemed kind of strange, although I don't know. I mean, I suppose if it was processed in a plant where they had eggs, raw eggs, or some, you know, who knows what, I guess you can imagine how, somehow it
In a setting like that, it may not be the food itself. It may be something in the machinery. It may be something in the container. It may, maybe something that's coming in contact with the peanut butter, but, may not be the peanut butter itself.
Yeah, I wasn't aware that peanuts could get
some.
They don't. Yeah.
No.
Okay. But again, I suppose there's the kind of thing that people do need to be a little bit concerned about. Certainly, if you're handling raw vegetables, you got to make sure that you wash them really well. And if you're dealing with things like eggs or raw meat, chicken particularly, that you need to follow the standard safe handling practices and make sure that it's well cooked. And if you've handled it, make sure you wash your hands and don't use the same cutting board or utensils.
Right, make sure that you clean off the surface that you've been working on. Right?
Yeah. Is it just that it's the kind of thing that's in the news, we notice it, we see it, or does it seem to you that somehow that it's maybe a more significant problem than it has been? Or is it pretty much about like it's always been?
I think it gets more attention, but no, I don't think it's any more prevalent than it ever was.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess we're about the point we have to finish up here. Any last thing that you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, I would like to encourage people to go at their snow shoveling slowly.
Have you seen some people with back problems?
Carefully. Yes, there have been quite a few people who've kind of overdone it and, take it easy.
We always say that, and yet, I've done it myself because if you're moderately active, it's not like the kind of thing that you do.
Unless you have a job shoveling coal, you are not used to that kind of activity.
All right. So take it easy. And if you hurt yourself, I guess you can always go for the ibuprofen and the hot pad afterwards. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, is a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He is here every other month for the show that we talk to the family doctor.